queers, queens, and in-betweens, hello and welcome to Same Sex, Same Shit. I'm your host, Rochelle. If you're queer and looking to start your fertility journey, you've come to the right place. Here you'll find journeys from all across Australia from other queer couples and solos. My fiancé Maddie and I have been through the journey ourselves, so along with other stories, we will share insights into what it is like being two mums and everything that comes along with that lesbian niche. We are so grateful that you're here. Enjoy. Today we have beautiful Laura on the podcast. She uses the pronouns she, her. Laura and her wife Georgie are from New South Wales, Australia. Their fertility journey involves using a known donor, and today she chats about what is involved in that process, as well as home inseminations and ultimately a successful second IUI. Laura also dives into the decision making around going through reciprocal IVF for their second pregnancy in the future. Laura, I am really looking forward to hearing and sharing your fertility journey today. For some context, would you mind starting off with who is a part of your family?
Absolutely. So my family is myself, my wife, Georgie, and our son, Rupert, who is nearly 9 months old.
Amazing. So I would love to begin hearing about what exploring and discovering your sexuality was like for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I did always know from a young age, but I didn't have a label for it. I just knew that I was attracted to women. And I didn't really know what that meant. I just knew that I needed to keep it a secret, and I knew that I couldn't tell people. And yeah, I knew that at the time it felt like it was something to be ashamed about. So it was something that I compartmentalized and just pushed to the side and tried to squander and not think about for a really long time. And then I remember when I was in my early 20s, I met this girl and she was bisexual. And I just remember looking at her and just feeling so jealous because she seemed so empowered and free. And I just looked at her and I knew that, you know, we had a commonality. And I was just, I just remember feeling so, so jealous of her being able to just step into that and own it. And then I became friends with a really cool group of gay men, and they used to hold these dinner parties like once a month. And it was so fabulous because they were all just really fabulous and creative and outspoken. And it felt like a really good environment to kind of start dropping the seed. Mm. So I identify as lesbian, but, you know, as all good gays do often when they come out, I came out as bisexual first. Yep. So I was like, oh, you know, I think I'm bisexual. And just seeing how it landed. And of course, none of them cared. And I don't think they really believed me because I am quite femme. Like, they were just like, oh, yeah, honey.
Yeah.
And so, so I think I kind of started there. And then I ended up moving to Sydney, and I was working in an emergency department where, honestly, you were like the odd one out if you weren't queer. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like there was just this really exciting community, and it just felt really right, and I felt really ready to come out. And then it was around the time of the same-sex marriage plebiscite, and it was just, I just got swallowed up by this incredible community that was just colorful and thrilling, and everyone was just so supportive. And it was just such a stark contrast from when I was young, because it almost was like, you know, oh God, I feel sorry for straight people because they don't get to be a part of it.
This is so much fun. Why doesn't everyone have pride parties?
Exactly. Yeah. You guys are missing out. So that was kind of, that was my journey.
Amazing. Oh, I love that. I love that so much. And it speaks so true. It is such a community, and it's really celebrated, and everyone is accepting, and it really makes you feel so nice and warm and welcome. So then how did you and Georgie meet?
Well, we actually met organically. We met face-to-face.
Oh, that's so unheard of these days.
Yeah, I know. It's so retro. So, so we met at a lesbian night called Girl Thing, which was at Imperial. So I was there with a couple of friends, and, it was such a powerful moment, actually. I was standing at the bar waiting to get a drink, and I turned around and Georgie was coming down the stairs, and we just locked eyes and kind of gave each other a bit of a cheeky smile. And it's honestly like just the most poignant moment in my life. I feel like I can remember everything about that moment. And yeah, so we had a fleeting kiss that night. And then we hadn't swapped information, but lesbian world, didn't take us long to track each other down. So we started messaging and then started dating, and it just was so easy. Like, everything with us has just always felt so natural. And yeah, I think previously in relationships, things felt a bit difficult or fiery or hard. And with Georgie, everything has just always been so much fun, and we just connect on so many points. So yeah, things progress pretty quickly. And it honestly, it wasn't long before, you know, both of us say that we just knew within about 3 dates that, you know, this person's going to be my wife.
Soulmates. And so yeah. Was Georgie your first woman that you had dated, or had you dated women prior to that?
No, I dated women prior to that. So yeah, I was actually dating a couple of people when I met Georgie.
I love that for you.
Yeah, like I think when I like after I came out, it was, you know, it was almost kind of like going back to like puberty, you know, because I didn't feel like I'd had all of the same experiences that a lot of other queer people had. And so, yeah, I kind of stepped into that. I did have one long-term girlfriend before Georgie, but other than that, I was just kind of just really enjoying dating and meeting people and kind of seeing where I fit and what kind of women I like.
And then so obviously you guys blossomed and you knew from quite early on. At what point and what did the discussions look like around fertility for you both and having kids?
Georgie and I had a similar experience in that I think growing up we never really saw ourselves having a family because we just thought that was going to have to be with a man, and neither of us could really envision that. And so we'd already discussed both feeling that way early. So I guess we both knew that we wanted to have a family because once we came out, that changed for both of us. We both felt like, yeah, okay, if it can be with a woman, I can definitely see this happening. So in terms of fertility, Georgie was definitely ready before me, and I'm a little bit older than Georgie. So that's actually, I was just like, no, I'm not ready. I don't know when I'm going to know, but I know it sounds silly, but I kind of just did. Like, all of a sudden I was like, no, I think this is something I'm ready for. And so, yeah, we got to planning, kind of planning out, seeking out clinics and stuff like that.
Sorry, how much did you know about the fertility space at that time? Did you have any queer friends that had gone through it, or were you just kind of basing it on your own research?
We didn't know very much at all. And like you and I were saying earlier, like, I think there just wasn't a lot of information out there for us. And we had one friend that had just been through a fertility journey. But other than that, and they were going through it as we were starting to plan. So they didn't really have all of the experience yet. But luckily, actually, I ended up connecting with this girl from Perth. I'm actually from Perth. And she had created a Facebook group because her and her partner were going through, her wife were going through fertility treatments. And it just kind of was a bit of a mash of people from all over Australia that had joined this little Facebook group and just started chatting. And she's actually one of my best friends now. We talk every day. So yeah, we just kind of, we lent on them a lot for a lot of their decisions because they were a little bit further ahead than us. But other than that, we didn't really know what we were doing. And I guess probably the most powerful part of our story, I guess, is our journey to decide on a donor. Because when we started, we're thinking we were going to use an anonymous donor, and our friend who was in the fertility process, they were using an anonymous donor. And I think some people think that it's going to make the non-birth parent feel more comfortable, like having that anonymity and that autonomy. And so I think that's what we thought. So we were like, yep, okay, we're going to use an anonymous donor. And then we got the app and we're looking at donors, and I was just having this really strong reaction to looking at anonymous donors, and I didn't know what was going on, but I would just cry every time I opened the app and started looking. And so I had to do a lot of self-reflection and kind of just figure out what was going on. And as someone who never met my father, and so I think for me, the prospect of having an anonymous donor and not knowing this side of our child's biology, it felt quite re-traumatizing for me. And I also, I didn't want our children to have that experience that I had had mm-hmm. about not knowing that side of them. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so obviously Georgie and I had a big conversation about it, and it did feel like quite a pivot mm-hmm. to then start thinking about using a known donor. And definitely we didn't know anyone that was using a known donor.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. And so at this point, are you affiliated with a clinic? Like, did you kind of do your research and start going through a clinic to then get that anonymous donor process going?
Yeah. So we had one appointment with a fertility specialist, and which was affiliated with a rainbow organization. Something I do think is important to comment on here is that we actually changed doctors and clinics a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I think I would implore people, if you have a gut feeling and something doesn't feel right, and especially if you are in those early stages, listen to that feeling and go and find another clinic or another doctor, because you're about to embark on a really long journey with that person, and there has to be so much trust. Mm-hmm. And if there's something that's not feeling right, like I have seen in Facebook groups after we changed clinics, we saw that there are a lot of similar reviews about those people. But people had like frozen embryos with them and stuff like that, and then they felt kind of tied to that mm-hmm. clinic and didn't feel like they could leave. And so we saw that, and we were just like, oh God, thank God we only had an initial appointment, and we were like, something just doesn't feel right, and then we moved. So I definitely think, although it's annoying to have to like go through your story again or engage with another clinic, like just try and look at it long term. Mm-hmm. It's definitely something I would recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And because you can then, like you said, tie a lot of emotion and financials up with that one clinic. And there is a lot of legalities state to state, clinic to clinic, about if you even can move embryos or changing donors, because a lot of things are affiliated with certain clinics, and there's a lot of issues around transferring embryos. They have to be kept at a very specific conditions and everything. So I absolutely agree with that comment. And Maddie and I did the same. We did a lot of research, and we actually met with a fertility specialist, and I said, I just don't vibe with him. Like, I don't really like him. And we ended up changing. So I totally agree with that. And then so talk me through the donor process from there. You said you didn't know any known donors. What did that look like for you? Because that would have then been quite stressful and confusing.
It wasn't that we didn't know anyone that was using a known donor.
Oh, sorry.
And I guess we had to start thinking, okay, who do we know that we could ask? Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things that were obviously really important to us. Like, we wanted someone who was healthy, obviously, and we also had a preference for our donor to be queer. And I think the reasoning behind that is that, well, obviously queer people are just better.
we're much more fun.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think it's, you know, around the world, it is made incredibly difficult for gay men to have children, which is obviously, you know, I can't wait for the day that changes. But I think I have a lot of gay male friends, and I have heard a lot of the time that people would be interested in contributing to a family, but they might not have the financial means to have a family themselves, or really want, you know, to be a parent, but they would like to contribute to a family in a way. Mm-hmm. And then also, I guess, having a known donor who had a female partner for us felt like they felt complex, mm-hmm. Particularly if they then wanted to have children in the future, you know, or if it was like a single man and he, you know, then partnered up and the partner wasn't happy or something like that. We had heard a couple of stories like that. And I think queer people are just used to coming together and helping each other out to mm-hmm. create a family as well. So, Yeah, so we had a think about some of the gay men that we knew. And luckily for us, we have an incredible friend who is smart and warm and just one of the loveliest people you could ever meet. And so, yeah, we decided we were going to ask him. And yeah, so that was obviously very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Him and his partner actually live overseas. So we had to kind of organize a FaceTime, which we like do talk. And I think we had FaceTime since they moved overseas as well. But we, you know, kind of like, oh, how do we, you know, drop this bomb? Like, yeah. How do we start this conversation? So yeah, we like sent a message and said, oh, hey, you know, there's something that we would love to talk to you both about. Like, it would be great if you guys could both be on the FaceTime. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, we have so much respect for our donors and now husband. So we wanted him to be a part of the conversation because really, you know, when you're married, as you know, all decisions are together.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so I think the advice I would give there is that I think it was good that he knew, he had a bit of an inkling about what we were going to ask him. And I would probably advise people in the future to maybe just plant a little bit of a seed for people, because yep. then it obviously doesn't come as a huge shock. And they have a bit of time to think about it before you have the conversation with them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, our donor suspected what we were going to ask and had already kind of, you know, thought about what his answer was going to be, yep. Which amazingly it was a yes. So there were obviously a few questions and things that we knew that we needed to nut out mm-hmm. moving forward. But I guess the most important, you know, question was, yeah, are you interested in helping us create a family? And he was. So
amazing.
Yeah, gosh, it makes me want to cry just thinking about it.
No, it's I
just
love that so much.
Yeah, I think people, they get scared, and I know this was true for us, is that you start to worry about having a known donor, that this person's going to like come in and swoop in and you know, take your children away from you in the future. But that's really just not the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are so lucky that we have this person in our lives. Our story, I'm so proud of it. Yeah. Like, it's just, it has taken lots of pivots and turns, but it's just the most beautiful partnership. And we all just have so much respect for each other, and our donor and his husband really just want to walk alongside us mm-hmm. and, you know, share the joy. And we definitely do that. Like, we send them pictures of Rupert and mm-hmm. videos, and we have FaceTimes with them. And yeah, so it's really such a beautiful partnership.
I think that sounds like almost best case scenario in this situation. That's so incredible. And so delving yeah. into that world of known donor sperm, mm-hmm. did you know about any sort of legalities, or did you, because I've heard a lot of mixed stories about contracts don't hold their weight, or they do, or mm. were you going to delve into that world?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I think so, we were with a clinic at that point, and so there are a few logistical challenges, one huge one being that he was overseas. Yes. So we had to get him and his sperm over here.
Yes.
So once we'd kind of organized the logistics around that, fortunately we were with a clinic that were just so easy. They just made everything, honestly, the fact that we had an overseas donor, it was like it didn't even matter. It was just a well-oiled machine. The doctors and even just the reception staff were just incredible. So we had some counseling appointments to have. And I think a lot of people feel this way, like when we were like, why do we have to do counseling? You know, counseling, mm-hmm. is it because we're gay? Like, but it actually isn't. Like, everyone has to do counseling, even straight or gay. Mm-hmm. And the counseling sessions were really helpful. They just gave us some things to think about and some questions to pose to our donor and his husband, and what the future was going to look like that we wouldn't have thought about ourselves. Also some like challenging questions as well, like if you both die, if one of you dies, like all these, mm-hmm. you know, pretty heavy questions. Georgie was like, one session she was crying. She was like, what? And but you know, I guess at the end of the day, like, you know, they really wanted us to have thought about all kind of different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so those questions really formed the basis of what we ended up putting into our statement of intent. So that mm-hmm. is the legal contract that is between us and our donor and his husband. So with that, Georgie actually found a template online.
Perfect.
And then built that from there. Georgie's dad is a lawyer, and Georgie's very clever, and she's very, very proud of her statement of intent. She put a lot of effort into it. And
I'm so glad you gave her a shout out with that. I'm sure she'll love that.
Yeah, she'll be waiting for it, don't worry. So yeah, she was very proud about what she put together. And then we had a lawyer look that over for us, so a family lawyer who had experience doing that for queer couples in the past. So I think because Georgie had done such a good job, I mean, it only cost about $3,000 for the mm-hmm. lawyer to look that over, which we mm-hmm. thought was pretty okay. And so, yeah, we had that kind of scripted up and then had our donor and his husband obviously read that and sign it. Look, I think at the end of the day, yeah, it's not the be all and end all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is just a contract that is agreed upon at that point in time, and things change. And I think one thing that is definitely true for our story is that when we created that contract, we were actually pretty hardline about a lot of things, because I think we did still have a bit of fear about our autonomy as parents, Georgie mm-hmm. and I. And so it really goes down to the minutiae of, you know, is our donor going to buy our children a birthday and a Christmas present every year? Mm-hmm. Like, are our donor's family allowed to contact us or contact our children? Like, mm-hmm. will they meet the children? Kind of stuff like that. So, and then obviously ongoing donation was a part of it. So our donor isn't going to donate to anybody else. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if we did need to do IVF in the future and you created embryos, like what is going to be done with those embryos? So it really goes into everything. It's very, very detailed. I can't remember how many pages it is.
Yeah,
it is very,
absolutely. Very long. Things that you wouldn't even think about or consider, but yeah, that whole not donating to someone else, which I think again is really, really beautiful and really a nice specialty that you guys have that not a lot of other queer couples who are going through anonymous donation have that luxury either. And yes, I know that yeah. Maddie and I explored the route of known donor. We had a friend actually approach us, a straight man married with his own kids, and it all seemed like quite nice and we were really happy. But then it kind of almost came to the crux of it, and he said, oh, you know, I've just had a big think about it and I can commit to the first one and the first kind of process, but I don't know how I'm going to feel after you guys have a kid, and I don't want to commit to endless donations. And I was like, okay, well, that's not going to work for us, because we don't want our family to be based on someone else's mental health and decision making, and we don't want to put that on them either. So yeah, there is a lot of complexities that do go into it. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I guess it all depends on how many children you want to have. And yeah, I guess, and this is the other thing, is that when you step into a fertility journey, you don't know how long you're going to be on that journey for. You don't know how quickly you're going to have success. And yeah, and that's why I think, yeah, there's so much to figure out. But yeah, we are very, very lucky with that situation with our donor. Our donor and his husband think that they might like to have children in the future. But yeah, there won't be any ongoing donation to anybody else. So
yeah, amazing. And then so what did the process look like from there? How did you get the sperm over, or what did you guys do? Were you doing home inseminations?
Yes. Yeah. So we flew our donor over, and then he came over to do his sample with the clinic. And we decided that we would give home insemination a try.
As well as going through that kind of like quarantine period with the clinic.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, he did his samples, and we did do one round of home insemination. So we just got a home insemination kit off the internet. I actually found that process quite stressful, because anyone who's been on a fertility journey knows, like, the counting and the predicting and the am I ovulating and how pregnant will I be at this month if I get pregnant this month, and oh my god, it was just
it's dreadful
It's so stressful. And so I found, yeah, the counting and the tracking of that really, really stressful. So that attempt wasn't successful. I guess something I would like to say here as well is that when you are, if you are going to try home insemination, you obviously, again, need to have a level of trust with your donor, because you likely won't have gone through that quarantine period where you've had the sampling and kind of all of the testing for STIs and stuff like that. So there does need to be a level of trust between you two. And I would encourage people to have open conversations, obviously, before they embark on doing that.
Of course.
Again, we're very lucky because we do have that relationship with our donor. So, yeah, I'm not surprised it didn't work, honestly, with how stressed I was. But yeah, so I found, I'm a medical professional, so I find being in medical spaces very comfortable. You know, I have a lot of trust in health. And so I found going through the clinic, I was just like, yep, just need to be a good girl and go to my blood tests, and then they'll tell me when I need to come in. So I found that a lot easier.
Took a lot of weight off your shoulders and responsibility. Yeah.
So, yeah. So then, then we went through the clinic, did IUI. Our first round wasn't successful. And that was really, I took that very, very hard. Again, I think people going through a fertility journey know that, you know, it's such a complex relationship with your own body. Like, you just feel so let down by yourself when it doesn't work, even though it's absolutely out of your control. So, yeah, I was very, very upset when that first round didn't work. And there is just, yeah, such a huge emotional toll that goes with every kind of attempt.
Of course. And did you know of or think that you might have had any fertility issues? Kind of, did you have regular cycles? You thought that it was all kind of going to go swimmingly?
Yeah, I for all our pre-fertility testing, I was really good, especially because I was 34 at the time. But yeah, had good egg count, no issues there. So, you know, but it's just ultimately it's a game of chance.
For sure.
So like, I mean, I don't know many people that have gotten pregnant on their first go. So yeah, so I think for the second try, I had just geared myself up. I was like, it's not going to work. I'm planning this trip to Bali with my best friend for when it doesn't work, so I've got something to look forward to. Yeah. And being a marriage celebrant, I remember, like, with the 2-week wait, I had a wedding that weekend, and then I had wedding meetings during the week. And so I was like, okay, I need to time my meltdown. So I need to time my test.
I cannot melt down at someone else's wedding.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm going to have to time my meltdown. So what day are we going to test so that, you know, I can be in bed crying for 2 days? So when we went for our second attempt as well, we were sitting there waiting to go in for the treatment. And the embryologist came in and said, oh, look, not as many of the sperm have survived the defrosting process as we would have liked. And so we'll go ahead today. But if you guys do try again, we'll probably need to move to ICSI, which is obviously a invasive type of IVF. And so I was like, oh, well, is there any point in us even going ahead today? Like, how much has survived? And she said, no, like, there is enough for today, but just moving forward, this is what we need to do. And she said, oh, you know, it only takes one. And it did.
And it did.
So, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's just so funny that she said that, because, yeah, it only takes one.
Did you feel different after that insemination?
No, not really, because I just learned to, you know, after a treatment, you're kind of like, oh, is that something? Like, oh, I think I feel sick? And you're just investigating kind of every little thing that happens to your body. And so I was trying to just be like, no. The only thing in retrospect, I was falling asleep on the couch every night at like 7 p.m. So I think I was quite tired. But, you know, it had been such a long process that I was just so exhausted anyway, to be honest, because although we'd only tried the 2 rounds with the clinic, like, we'd done the home insemination try before that, and there was just a lot of lead up.
And then, yeah, all of the lead up is so exhausting as well. You know, with queer fertility journeys, you get to the end of the pregnancy and say you're 30 weeks, 36 weeks, whatever. And you're like, holy shit, this has been going for a really long time. Because not only do you know the day that you're pregnant almost, you know, you then do all of that pre-treatment as well, which it just feels like it's the longest process in the world to get to the finale.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I had to keep reminding myself of that because I was so tired in pregnancy. And I think that's because, yeah, you've already been on this incredibly long journey. So you're kind of even more exhausted, I think, than the average pregnant person because you've had that huge emotional toll before that as well. But yeah, so I waited obviously to do the test and timed my, you know, impending meltdown and did the test. And I said to Georgie, I was like, no, I want to look at it first this time. And because I think I wanted to be the first one to see that it wasn't that I wasn't pregnant.
For sure.
And then, yeah, I just looked at it and I was like, oh, no. Oh, no.
I didn't prepare for this.
She was like, what? And I was like, I'm pregnant. And we just both started like screaming, but I was saying like, oh, no, because I think I just was not prepared for it at all. And I was like, we're going to have to cancel Bali.
My meltdown trip is no longer.
Yeah. So yeah, it was just wild because I'd really, really set myself up for it to be negative. So it was just and yeah, definitely, obviously, with what the embryologist had said, I was like, there is no chance this is going to work. So yeah, it was so crazy.
That's amazing. And then so after your pregnancy and birth with Rupert, did you at any point kind of think about if you guys did want more kids, what that would look like? Were you kind of like, okay, well, that was fine. That ended up working with the IUI. Maybe we'll just continue to try that in the future. Or did you have any kind of thoughts looking at, you know, obviously IVF and ICSI is quite an expensive process. So then potentially saving for that down the future?
Oh, no, we definitely already, like, that was probably before we even tried the first time, we kind of already knew what we wanted it to look like. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm a little bit older than Georgie, and so we knew that it was always going to be me that went first because of that. And we decided because of that that we would just keep it really simple the first time and use my egg and try IUI, because Georgie wasn't sure whether or not she wanted to carry. So we knew that we felt for our queer family that we wanted to both have a child that we were biologically connected to. So obviously the first time was going to be me, and then it gave Georgie some time to kind of think about whether or not she wanted to carry. So Georgie identifies as female and uses she, her pronouns, but in terms of her gender expression, being pregnant doesn't really fit with that, and she just can't imagine her being pregnant. And so I think seeing me go through it, and even for me, I found the changes to my body quite difficult, like, you know, just gaining weight and being shift. And so I kept thinking to myself, like, adding a layer of kind of, you know, this different gender expression on top of that, I just knew that that would be really difficult for Georgie. And so, yeah, to be honest, like, I had a good pregnancy and I didn't mind being pregnant. Postpartum, got some other things to say different about postpartum. was not prepared for that at all. But yeah, so I will be up again because, like I said, we do want to have a baby that is biologically Georgie's. So we'll use the same donor, and that was obviously all a part of our contract as well. And yeah, so we'll do reciprocal IVF this time around, and I will carry.
And did you know a whole lot about reciprocal IVF before, like during your research of fertility, or has it something that's kind of just more so popped up with the discussions around both having a biological child and Georgie not wanting to carry?
We don't know a lot about it, to be honest. We just know that luckily for us in New South Wales, it is an option. And I definitely want to take, the opportunity to say that is like state to state. It's just not equal. Like, we just do not have equality across the board for queer families in Australia. It's absolutely insane that my friends in Perth can't have a baby the way they want to, like Georgie and I can, because we're living in New South Wales. That is
WA infuriates me.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And being from WA as well, it's so disheartening because, you know, we see ourselves back there one day, but we can't move back there until we have our second child. So that just puts a lot of kind of boundaries on us being able to, you know, move around and do what we want to do with our lives. So, yeah, we don't know a lot about it. We know that that's definitely what we're going to try the next time around. We do have a very close friend. Her and her wife are about to start that process, and they've kind of been going through the pre-fertility stuff at the moment. And about to launch into treatment soon. So I'm sure that we'll learn a lot from their experience. But yeah, I think luckily for us, there will be one couple for us to hear about their experience and learn from, because at the time that we were doing it, it really didn't feel like that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Maddie and I felt relatively similar, but I think the way that I kind of looked at it and the way that I kind of try and explained it to people is that it's really essentially quite similar to an IVF process. You're getting eggs retrieved and then putting back in. So a lot of people think that reciprocal IVF is going to be more expensive, but it's the same process. It's just two people, one person getting their eggs out and the other one getting the embryo transfer. So there's no extra procedures involved per se. The biggest thing that we found difference-wise compared to just a straightforward IVF cycle was that there was more paperwork, in the sense of your eggs, your embryos into them, and the same thing, like what if you died, can they do something with your embryos and yada yada. So just more legality paperwork, but like overall from a process perspective, I don't think that people should see it too differently, and it shouldn't be taken too differently. It's such a beautiful way to create a family if that's something that aligns with your family, and I really am so grateful that it's an option to so many of us in Australia. WA definitely need to catch up, but I know that we were chatting off camera and you mentioned that you were looking at going through a public clinic this time around. Is that right?
We did go through a public clinic for our cycle with Rupert.
Okay. Yeah. And so what's their take on reciprocal IVF?
Don't do it. They don't do it.
Okay.
So, I don't know what this next round is going to look like. It's probably going to look like going through a private clinic, which I didn't kind of get too far into it before, but we were with a private clinic and then we moved to the public clinic. So we did a lot of when our donor came over and did his samples, that was all with the private clinic, which is why it was just this amazing, well-oiled machine. So I think we'll probably go back there. We felt really, really safe with the doctor there and that clinic. So I'm guessing we'll go back there. But, yeah, it is obviously a lot more expensive. And I think that's another thing to say, is that when we were starting this process, there's just no costing transparency. And so a lot of the time when you're embarking on a fertility journey, it's also a time when you might be buying your first home or have a lot of expenses. And so, you know, there's all these kind of, I heard it's like $30,000 a try. And, you know, you hear all these stories and then you go online and try and figure it all out. And with, you know, Medicare rebates, and you might get this rebate and they might class you as this and that might help. And it's so confusing and overwhelming. And we found as well that some of those first clinics that we engage with and doctors, we would, you know, ask them, so what's the cost of that? Oh, I don't know. I don't deal with the money. And it's like, how can you not know?
Of course, you know
what you're proposing to us. Yeah. And so, it just felt like we had to really, really dig for it at the start then. And that just felt so terrifying, because we just didn't know, you know, gosh, are we going to have to take money out of our super? Are we going to be able to buy our first home? So, yeah, luckily for us at the public clinic, IUI was very, very cost effective. And obviously we know that that's not going to be our story the next time. So, just preparing for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard an obstetrician fertility specialist down in Melbourne once say, I actually did an interview with him on his podcast, and he essentially said that we don't have to deem people medically infertile. The wording is infertile, and whether that is socially infertile, which is the strange term that they give us queer people, or whether that is medically infertile, it shouldn't be a fact of you have to be deemed infertile, you have to do two IUIs before you can go to IVF. And we, Maddie and I were very fortunate that our fertility specialist was kind of on the same page as that. But there is this huge misconception around having to spend this money and go through these processes of IUIs before you can get a Medicare rebate. And I think it's just crazy that, as again, another thing that's not stock standard across the board is that infertile is a very broad term, and you cannot fight against if a fertility specialist says these people are infertile for whatever reason, because we can't make a baby together with the two of our eggs.
Exactly. So and if a straight couple went into a clinic and, you know, say the man didn't have any sperm, they would never, you know, they would completely understand when, you know, or for some reason, you know, he had some kind of fertility issue, they would completely understand why a straight couple would want to have both of their genetics to, in some way, together to create that child. But in terms of reciprocal IVF, it's like, oh, it's so bizarre that these two queer people want to, you know, have some kind of partnership in the way that they're creating a child. I just don't understand why people can't understand why we want to do that. Honestly, like, working in health, you know, there was an LGBTIQ plus health strategy released in 2022. You know, we're 2024, and that strategy, in my perspective, is completely tokenistic. I haven't seen any service, particularly not the fertility space, really take that on and put anything into action in a real way. I could go on and on, but it kills me when people are like, you guys can get married now, yay, equality. And it's like, oh my gosh, we have so far to go.
We have so far to go.
Yeah, and in terms of like classing people as infertile as well, like if you are a queer family and one of the people is gender diverse, like that person cannot carry a child, because it does not, like that would completely psychologically shatter that person because they are gender diverse. And so how can you not understand that and take that into account when people are embarking on a fertility journey?
There's a lot of aspects that aren't taken into consideration, you know, mental health particularly being one. There's already so much of the process that we go through, and I absolutely agree. And it is really interesting. I've heard a lot of stories of couples going through the public fertility system and then them saying, okay, but we actually don't have a donor program, so you have to be straight basically to
So that was the same with our clinic. So you had to have your own sperm because they don't have a donor program.
So, yeah, so that's another hurdle then.
It's geared for straight people. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we had so many clunky interactions along our journey. You know, I went for pre-fertility treatments with an acupuncturist, and she asked me if I was going to have sex with our donor. I was like, no, I'm a married lesbian and our donor is a married gay man. So no, we're not going to have sex.
And the whole point of having a donor is that just that donation.
Yeah. But, you know, people just honestly, and she kept referring to, oh, well, I've never looked after someone like you before. I've never encountered people like you. I was just like, if this woman says people like me one more time, I'm going to lose it.
Oh, like so different. You're so different.
Yeah. So,
That's crazy.
It's just, we have a long way to go in terms of language and just feeling, really supported by. I will say that our clinic is in the Inner West, and so they were great.
Like, amazing.
They're onto it with their language. That hospital is just, you know, painted with rainbows. And so we did feel very well supported by that clinic.
Yeah, amazing. It definitely does weirdly depend on the demographic of the area as well. You know, like there would be quite a big queer community there potentially versus somewhere a little bit more remote where they would only see one queer couple a year, maybe, if that So I get that. Oh, well, thank you so, so much for sharing your fertility journey. And I'm so excited for what you are about to embark on in the future, and best of luck with everything. But yeah, thank you so, so much for going into all of that with the donor process and your whole journey. I really appreciate it, and it will provide so much value to our community. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome.
Thank you all so much for listening today. If you'd like to connect with us and stay up to date with our day-to-day life as well as future episodes, you can do so on our socials at those.2mums. We absolutely love bringing you these conversations each week, so if you love it too, please subscribe and leave us a review. Chat to you all next week. Bye.